Hello and welcome back to New Books in National Security, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Beth Windisch, your host, and today we will be talking with George Perkovich and Ariel Levite about their new book, Understanding Cyber Conflict, 14 Analogies. George and Ellie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
You go first, Ellie. So 25 years in the Israeli government in different national security positions in the National Security Council, MOD, and Atomic Energy Commission. Here and there, academic stints, and for the past decade with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in the nuclear policy and cyber policy programs.
And I'm George Perkovich. I've been here at the Carnegie Endowment for the last 16 years. 12 years before that, I worked at a grant-making foundation that worked on international security issues. And before that, I worked for then-Senator Joe Biden. Like Ellie, much of my work over the years has been focused on nuclear weapons-related issues. And then we both got drawn into questions about cyber conflict about, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago.
You mention in the book that there was a previous volume on this subject. Could you tell us a little bit about that and what led you to this effort?
Yeah, the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, organized a volume of anthologies, and a friend of ours, a colleague at U.S. Cyber Command, Emily Goldman, with the man at the Naval Postgraduate School, John Archia, they had done their analogies. We looked at them and thought they were quite interesting. But they themselves felt like that the analogies were useful and people found them, you know, very helpful in trying to understand and think about cyber and how cyber is different or similar to other things. But they felt that they didn't have, that they left out a lot of analogies that could be even more useful. And in particular, were wanting to think about and identify and elaborate analogies that have more kind of international relevance. And so they asked us if we would consider doing, in a sense, a successor volume that would probe some more contemporary analogies. So, for example, in our book, we have a chapter by David Sanger of the New York Times on drones and how that's analogous to cyber. We have a chapter by our colleague James Acton on precision-guided weapons and cyber, so things like Tomahawk cruise missiles or others. So those kind of more contemporary analogies weren't in the first volume. And then there were some more distant historical analogies that we found could be quite interesting, also that weren't in the first volume, and we've put them in ours.
And a related rationale, I would add, was that since they produced the first volume on cyber analogies, which was a much shorter version, it became clear to them how important the analogies have become for helping people in senior policy positions who have not thought about cyber warfare before, and that this would be kind of a very useful heuristic to bring them up to speed of the kind of issues they need to think about in ways that they would find compelling because of the narrative. So it was both the international, the more comprehensive, but also the more policy, the relevant goal that produced, that helped catalyze the second volume.
Yeah, I think you're touching a little bit on my next question, too. You talk about the use of analogies to explain different concepts and how they can be helpful. And I think you even gave an example of where it can be potentially misleading. How are analogies helpful to explain cyber conflict?
Well, some of it is, it's just how human beings think and learn, right? I mean, if we stop ourselves at any time during the day, you know, we can realize how often we're using analogies, basically drawing on past experience or things that one's learned to make sense of new data, new phenomena. And so, since all we're doing is articulating and making conscious how much we do that, but in the specific area of national security, you run into all the time. For example, give you an example. In the debate over the nuclear deal with Iran a couple of years ago, and even today, it was often the Munich analogy was often invoked by some antagonists in the debate. They would say this is appeasement, like Neville Chamberlain appeased Hitler, et cetera. So Munich was often there. Proponents of the deal often invoke Vietnam, and so you see that in the discussion about Syria, just as we speak today. There will be people who are saying, it would be a quagmire like Vietnam. There are other people that are saying this was like what we did and regretted with Rwanda when there was a genocide. It's how people think and debate and make sense of anything new is by invoking the past. So we wanted to help and identify analogies that we know are prevalent when people think about and talk about cyber, and to analyze how actually valid are they, or in what ways are these analogies misleading. And so a policymaker or journalist should be very careful about using the analogy in a certain way.
And to be more concrete here, the two most prevalent analogies that are being invoked to think about cyber are Pearl Harbor on the one hand, and the nuclear analogy on the other. Mm-hmm. Those are quite prevalent, but they're partially useful and partially misleading. By invoking other analogies on the one hand and analyzing those on the other, what we wanted to show was that they do bring to the fore some interesting questions and make you think about some issues, but the answers they may lead you to think about may not be the relevant answer. So the Russians may hack American elections, but they won't do a kind of a Pearl Harbor type of thing. And that's actually more likely that you would have things on the lower end than on the higher end, a Pearl Harbor type and so on. And thinking about nuclear weapons as the most catastrophic weapons also implies in it the reluctance to use them. That's not the case with cyber weapons. So just to show you why discussing current analogies, which lead you to think certain ways that currently invoked analogies, and at the same time producing others that you may with this think about, that makes you lead about other types of scenarios, questions, and dilemmas.
It's a fascinating way to look at the issue, so I appreciate it. It was a very interesting read. In the first section, you examine what cyber weapons are and draw some parallels to explain them. What can the history of intelligence operations tell us about the potential uses of cyber assets?
Well, this was a really interesting chapter, I think, and it was written by the historian at U.S. Cyber Command. And so among the – let me focus on the differences. I mean, he talks about, for example, you know, how radio technology was hugely revolutionary for intelligence. Both in how you can gather information, but also how you can then communicate what you find. And there are other ways in which, you know, cyber to gather intelligence builds on prior methods. But there's at least one huge difference that he talks about. And that is the way in which the cyber means by which a state, for example, can penetrate another country's systems and gather information from them, whether it's military institutions, banks, other things. That is great capacity. It allows a state to have a much wider range of targets and so forth. But what's really transformative is the same operation by which you spy through cyber means can also be a means of attacking. And that's fundamentally different. So if you, in the old days, you know, you had, a spy in this agency or that agency, they could gather information, they might be able to do some kind of sabotage, but they couldn't do anything remotely as extensive in terms of switching from spying to attacking, as can now be done with cyber means. And I think that's a very important issue as countries and citizens are wrestling with cyber, and that is the extent to which people, institutions are gathering information about all of us and about governments. You could call that spying, but the question about whether and how they would switch to attacking, and for example, corrupting the integrity of your data, is something we're just beginning to wrestle with.
A related issue is that intelligence, there are generally very few rules of the game. So it's a fair play. I can spy on you, you can spy on me. At least over the last 100 years, that has become the norm. So if the US, for example, had discovered that the Chinese were spying on the Office of Personnel Management, the US intelligence professionals had said, well, too bad, but that was a fair thing, and the US would do the same to China. What complicates things is the same intelligence machinery wearing a different, maybe organizational hat, like in the case of Cybercom versus NSA, would actually go ahead and do type of hacking as the Russians have done. That assumes an entirely different meaning. And here you're saying, this is not fair play. This is unacceptable. And so both of them are shrouded in secrecy, a big part of it. But one of them, you actually say, here are some rules of the game of what is unacceptable. Whereas spying is generally tolerated, and there are some rules that if you get caught, you get slapped on the hand, spies get exchanged, and you move on.
So, for example, just to belabor this, because it's a really important one, and building on what Ellie said, historically, there aren't examples of an intelligence operation, a spy being caught that leads to war, that produces conflict. As Ellie said, it's assumed that states will do it. Eventually, there's an exchange of spies. They walk over a bridge and make a movie about it. It's just part of life. But if you get spying on a scale that can be done through cyber, and because there are these concerns that it can be morphed into attack, there is a worry that through miscommunication, misinterpretation, some of this kind of activity could be seen as a trigger to conflict.
I think that's a good transition to the next chapter that looks at the use of cyber capabilities as non-lethal weapons. And I was curious, when reading this, do you believe the recent cyber attacks in Atlanta are an example of a potential use of this type of non-lethal force?
I think what happened in Atlanta and what's been happening in other places is it probably isn't the best analogy to the use of force. It's a different form of, to my mind, of kind of political protest or symbolic action. What we were thinking of and what the chapter on the non-lethal use of force has in mind are actually first of all, incapacitating weapons or military operations. So let me back up. It's hard to imagine that an act regarding Atlanta, it's hard to imagine that an actor or whoever was behind it would have blown up City Hall in Atlanta. All right. Because that has an effect that's so dramatic. It causes death, destruction. The response that it would trigger would be fairly intensive. And it's hard to imagine that the actors would have any support for what they had done. Whereas kind of a cyber shutdown of city functions doesn't obviously harm anybody physically. Nothing blows up. It's more of a statement that generates different kinds of responses. So we were thinking about in this context more of if you can shut down, for example, a part of a country's air force by cyber operations rather than thinking about shooting down their planes with your own planes or with missiles. How might that affect the dynamics of war or the likelihood of getting into conflicts in the first place?
If you think of cyber weapons or more broadly cyber capabilities as analogous to weapons of mass destruction and their employment as resulting in situations like Pearl Harbor, your first instinct says, how do we prevent their use? If you think of them as potentially things that have a more transient, reversible, and non-harmful effects in the sense of at least bodily harm, then your first instinct says, how can we leverage them in ways that are in between use of force and doing nothing against certain types of provocations or acute security challenges? So you are much more nuanced in terms of thinking maybe they do have potential uses that are useful, legitimate, reasonable under some circumstances.
So here's another example that's closer to one that was mentioned in the chapter. Tear gas is an example of a non-lethal weapon, right? You use police and authorities use it for crowd control to disperse people. Well, what if through cyber means you can, by cutting off, for example, social media, you prevent the demonstration from happening in the first place? Or by using cyber means you divert people to a different site than where the main demonstration is. Or you change the date. There are all sorts of ways you can imagine that are non-lethal. They don't even hurt people's eyes, like tear gas does. But from the point of view of the state, may accomplish the same thing of either preventing or breaking up a demonstration. That's an example more along the lines of what Ellie was saying, where you kind of go from the state's point of view, cyber may be a more desirable way to accomplish the objective. And indeed, from the standpoint of the opponents of the state, it may be more desirable in terms of the pain that is visited upon them.
The analogy of cyber weapons to precision-guided missiles implies an ability to control these types of attacks. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. The question was that the appeal of cyber weapons might be a lot greater if one would have thought about them as things that have a much more localized, precise effects. And the question was whether the trend that we had seen with conventional weapons is likely to be evident in the cyber weapons as well. And I think on the whole, the answer is, at least for the time being, that cyber capabilities aren't able to deliver effects which could be so tailored as precision-guided munitions. And that's one of the major handicaps. So maybe they're preferable in terms of use because they don't cause widespread harm, but at the same time, if we can't predict what their second-order or third-order effects might be, we may have to think twice or third or three times and so on about what their implications might be. So if we give an example, if the Russians had thought that, you know, they might help Hillary or they are conversely help Donald Trump and so on somewhat or complicate the U.S. trust in the system of elections, that's one story. But if they had thought that the second order effect would be dramatic U.S. Gearing up or ganging up on Russia and applying major sanctions and beyond, maybe they would have had second feelings about the impact and so on. And they couldn't. You start with it and you may not be able to calculate what the second and third order effects are. You're trying to shut down electricity supply in one very small place, and then you don't understand the connectivity of the network actually brings down electricity supply for a whole city, or it lasts a lot longer than you anticipated, or it also causes electricity to fail in hospitals and things of that nature. So the analogy was designed to say, okay, here is a benchmark, precision-guided munitions. They've become quite popular because they make it possible in an affordable way to have very precise effects. So it's also more legitimate, so to speak,
because there are fewer non-combatants that are being affected. Is cyber up to it? And the answer is, for now, certainly not.
Another thing that comes out of that analogy that I think is quite subtle, and our colleague James Acton wrote this, is in both cases, in other words, if you use a cruise missile to attack a electricity transmission system, it's very important that you get what's called battle damage assessment. In other words, you want to very quickly be able to assess that you hit the target, that the attack succeeded, the electricity's off, and you'd like to know, when it could be restored. With cyber, you have even a greater challenge of doing battle damage assessment. So with precision guided weapon, you rely on satellites or drones or other means to take pictures of the thing that was hit, and you do that over time, and we know well how to do that. With cyber, it won't be so visible whether the damage was done, and also, as Ellie said, whether the damage extended to other networks, or it might potentially. And it's much, in most cases, the people whose organizations were targeted will be able to restore the function much quicker than after there's been physical destruction of a target. And if you're the attacker, you're the U.S., you've used this cruise missile, in some instance, but a cyber in another instance, you really want to know when your opponent is back up and running again. And that requires a fairly constant capacity to be in their network from a cyber point of view, which you may not be able to sustain, because once they know they've been attacked, they will take measures to kick you out of there, and you may no longer be able to assess whether you've performed the mission. And so that intelligence challenge is much greater with cyber.
Another technology used to explain some of the challenges with cyber was the chapter about drones. And it speaks to the legal and ethical questions that arise with new technologies and capabilities. How is the drone experience instructive to cyber capabilities?
Well, in many ways, and this was an interesting chapter that David Sanger of the New York Times wrote. And one of them right off the top that's very important is, for the most part, first of all, the U.S. and to some extent Israel have been the primary users of drones, number one. Number two, for the most part, the U.S. Has used drones to kill individuals, to kill human beings. And that's very different from the way in which any actor has used cyber. We're not aware of a cyber attack that has directly killed a person. And so the distinctions there, we think, are quite important. There are similarities, as David brings out in the article, that, the idea is, again, the precision. The idea of similarity is that drones, especially unarmed drones, are invaluable for intelligence gathering because they can hover a very long time over an area. And so that's why the U.S. and many other countries are investing heavily in drones, is to be able to gather intelligence. Well, as we talk about in the intelligence chapter on cyber, cyber provides a great means also for gathering intelligence. But it's when you come to targeting individuals that there's a big difference.
Let me add two other issues very quickly. Number one, you are falling victim to the ability to operate secretly. I mean, there is something tempting about the ability to do these as clandestine operations that are not seen by the broader public and so on, to try and rely more and more on these tools to conduct operations. And so what starts very surgically and eclectically and carefully reviewed missions and so on, over time becomes something you rely on more and more, because the temptation is so great that you could get away with it, and you really don't pay much of a price to do so, and you're not subject to much public scrutiny when you employ that capability and so on, and you don't put your troops in harm's way, and those are some of the issues involved. And the second aspect of this is that in the UAV case, what looked very tempting was the partial illusion that you can really, really localize the effects. And what transpired over time was that a lot of faulty intelligence, some of it deliberately provided to you by some people who want to settle scores and so on, resulted in a lot of collateral damage and a lot of non-combatants getting killed in weddings and other places and so on. But you were kind of sucked into doing more and more on those until you understood what vicious dynamics you were finding yourselves into.
The book also looks at general questions of what cyber warfare may look like. And how does the recent scandal involving Cambridge Analytica and Facebook relate to the book's examination of information warfare?
Well, there's a great chapter in the book by Stephen Blank on Russia and information warfare. And what's interesting is that that chapter was written before the revelations about the U.S. election and before anyone had ever heard of Cambridge Analytica. But what it documented was basically that from the beginning of the Soviet Union, or at least the 1920s, the instruments of the state, especially the intelligence apparatus, the KGB and others, had a very important and well-developed strategy of information operations or information warfare. It's a combination of propaganda, deceptive publication, political influence. And by the way, I mean, the U.S. and Western countries to varying degrees at various times in the Cold War did something similar. But what Stephen's chapter elaborates is the overall kind of strategy and thinking that had gone into Soviet information operations, and how that basically the same institutions, in many cases the same actors with the same philosophy, basically embraced cyber technology as they naturally would as a new tool to use for, you know, traditional purposes. And so what we've experienced in, 2016, 2017, and we're experiencing now is not something profoundly different in its purpose, in the actors who are conducting it, but rather it's the effectiveness, because cyber techniques now allow you to operate at the speed of light, basically, and to hit so many targets of your information operations at exactly the same time. So it becomes much more effective, but it's the same actors with the same basic purposes.
To add to what George had said, the Facebook story basically tells you that the name of the game is now information. It's data. The reason it's important, and the story that George is focusing our attention is that information is being weaponized. It's the denial of information, the corruption of information, and the distortion of information, and the ability to target it at certain audiences. So what if one had thought about cyber warfare as mainly designed to achieve physical impact? You now begin to understand that a great deal of cyber warfare already, and looking ahead, will actually be trying to affect cognition. It's a very different way of looking at the challenge.
And this is where actually warfare may itself be the wrong analogy. It's one of the reasons we use conflict in the title and throughout the book, because when people think of warfare, they think of bloody bodies for good reason. Whereas the Soviet strategists from decades ago, but also the chief of the general staff now, General Gerasimov, they talk a whole lot about, the optimal strategy is the one that achieves your objectives without a shot being fired and without anybody being killed. And so that really brilliant military or state strategy today will mobilize, as Ellie said, information operations or cyber means to affect the way that adversaries think, to divide them, to turn them against each other, to split alliances, to turn citizens against their own government, to make them actually think more benignly of your own state. All of these ways to affect people's cognition and psychology are, to the Russian view right now, absolutely vital means of national strategy, especially if you feel that your conventional military forces, your Air Force, your Navy, your Army, may not be able to defeat the adversary's military forces, then you want to invest even more in this kind of way of politically defeating the adversary before a shot's fired.
So in the warfare section, there's also an analogy between cyber and rail, and both are described as facilitating technologies. Can you talk more about that analogy and the dilemmas that dual-use technologies present?
Yeah, this came out of, when you're talking about rails, it in particular has to do with World War One, and there was for a long time, historians had a view that one of the reasons that World War One happened, right? And many people now look back at it and say, this was just this big mistake. How could it happen? It was such a disaster. But one of the arguments for why it happened was railways. They were a new technology. They had just become prevalent in Germany, in France, and the militaries began relying on them to mobilize forces. And once you depended on railways to mobilize your forces, given the numbers of tracks and the need to choreograph all of these movements, if you thought conflict was happening, you would mobilize your troops and rail them to the front as quickly as possible. And then that would create momentum that was very hard to reverse. Historians since have basically not debunked, but put the issue of railways into a larger context and say, look, this isn't what caused World War One. But the analogy is still there and often invoked. So Frank Gavin, an historian, wrote this chapter and basically said that the main thing to think about is that, like railways, cyber compresses the amount of time that decision makers have to avert momentum for war. So if World War One began after the assassination of the Archduke in Sarajevo, and many people would say through the summer, pressure for war built faster than the political systems could respond to in managing ways that would avert the war. That means that, in a sense, technology compressed the time. Well, cyber arguably will compress time even more, to make it that much harder for decision makers and when you have a bunch of major powers involved to kind of sort out their differences and avert war. And so that's a very concerning dynamic of the compression of time. The conclusion that Frank draws in the chapter is that ultimately what caused World War One or prevented its being averted was that Europe was under-institutionalized. In other words, there weren't institutions, there weren't frameworks, there weren't patterns of interaction amongst those states that could be mobilized for diplomacy to avert the war. It was the means of diplomatic crisis aversion were underdeveloped. And he argues that a similar thing exists in key regions today, especially regarding cyber. And we see this with the U.S. and Russia today. We're not getting into physical war, but in a lot of ways, diplomacy is breaking down. And cyber can make that challenge of building diplomatic channels in time very difficult because of the pace at which major cyber attacks could happen.
Let me address your dual use aspect. If you look now at a book which is 20 years old, it's called The Victorian Internet, which discusses how the telegraph has evolved in the 19th century. And the kind of dilemmas that technology that was initially seen as something mainly for news sharing and subsequently for commercial application actually became a mechanism for having an advantage over others, not just in the commercial area or in the news gathering and passing along, or even in the family exchange, but also in the military application. So what happens is you develop a technology originally for purposes that look to you like they're very specific. I mean, look at the Facebook as an example. And then you realize that regardless of whether you had commercial intentions or you wanted to make the world flatter and more connected in the social aspects of the sense, this could actually be weaponized or it could become another battleground. So that's, I think, is what we're trying to get at by invoking some of these dual use technologies.
Where do non-state actors come into play? You allude that some cyber capabilities can be easily copied. Is it possible that an attack may be conducted by an actor outside the system of international norms?
Well, this is perhaps the most important or one of the most important ways in which cyber is different from other forms of conflict. It's profoundly important. So let's take, for example, ownership. Most of the cyber infrastructure, or what we call cyberspace, is owned and operated by private actors. You know, companies who you know, created a lot of the systems, phone companies that, you know, own the transmission lines. That's not the case with navies and air forces and armies, right? Governments own those and fight with each other on these. But here, if you're talking about conflict, much of that conflict would be conducted in and through spaces and in a sense, infrastructure that's owned by private actors and then also operated by many individual citizens. So, you know, the attacks that we know about, or when ransomware attacks happen, often, right, bots and other things have taken over individual citizens' computers without those citizens knowing that they've, in a sense, been weaponized. So it's the means by which conflict is fought are in many ways dispersed and privatized in ways that are totally unlike normal warfare. And then that enables a totally greater range of actors to get involved. So, you know, if you were worried about something like Pearl Harbor, only another country had the capacity to mobilize that kind of air power. But there are all sorts of criminal networks or countries, even, you know, as relatively weak as North Korea or terrorist groups that can mobilize through cyber and basically attack any country.
Add one more layer to it. As the Brits have been discussing this week for the first time, it's not just a threat posed by these non-state actors, but also fighting them has relied increasingly on cyber capabilities. And what the Brits have been talking about is how they've actually leveraged those capabilities against ISIS, because their impact, being non-state actors, is very localized unless they can actually spread the word. And so the means of spreading the word is heavily dependent on those cyber capabilities, which are cheap, accessible, secure because of the cryptographic aspects and so on. If you can disrupt those, you complicate a great deal both the coordination of their efforts, which is dispersed locally, spatially and over time and so on, but also the appeal of their message to others who have thus far not been energized to the cause. So it's both the challenge they pose, which is cyber-enabled, and the way of fighting them, which increasingly harnesses cyber tools.
That really dovetails nicely into the cyber defense chapter, looking at active and passive defense. and the Air Force is cited as an example. How does this analogy help us understand cyber defense? And is cyber defense more complex because of the private sector's ownership of infrastructure?
I'll start, and Ellie will come in. Your last point, yes, the importance of privately owned and operated nodes in the system, their importance in defending from attack is quite different than, for example, defending airspace from attack. And so that's key. You really need, given the way technology and networks were designed, which wasn't with security in mind, right? We need to figure out how to mobilize so many private actors, whether it's producers of technology and software or users in the corporate space or in individual space, to help to deny kind of entrance points for attackers. That's very, very important. What the chapter that you're referring to goes farther, and it examines, for example, through the analogy of air defense, under what conditions is it okay to shoot down an incoming airliner, which could kill people? And in this case, the analogy is, you know, to use cyber means to take down a computer or an infrastructure that's facilitating it. And one of the questions is, well, if it's in your own network, the right to do that seems pretty clear. But if in order to stop the attack, you need to actually, through cyber means, go out of your network into somebody other's network, which may be based in another country or owned by citizens of another country, what legal, ethical, and strategic issues does that raise? This chapter explores those and basically finds that a lot of the legal principles and ethical principles that we've developed around, you know, questions of air defense can be applied metaphorically as you think about dealing with cyber defense. But Ellie and colleagues have been doing a lot of other work on this question of kind of active cyber defense.
Yeah, and I think that the issue to highlight here in this context of the book is to basically say the offensive and defensive capabilities are basically complementing each other. And it's very difficult to think of things that are neatly exclusively defensive or exclusively offensive, or even what is called the CERTs, which is the centers that are supposed to do cyber emergency response. If you actually have the resilience and the protection, you may have a freer hand to attack others. So what looks on the face of it like an exclusively defensive capability, even before it's used, already may assume the eyes of others, but also into eyes of your own leadership, as something that frees your hand to engage in offensive operations. A second aspect to the whole thing is that that some of the defensive operations actually require to be in the other side's network to know what's coming. And we've seen a lot of recent examples of how this has come in handy, both to prevent attacks, but also to attribute those, to figure out who was actually the one who instructed those and who was the ones behind those who actually carried them out, and whether it's Putin that gave the instruction or somebody else and so on. So a lot of this basically says that the traditional way of saying this is purely defensive, as this is purely offensive, both in terms of capability, the physical capability, as well as the use, isn't really that neatly applicable to cyber and so on. And what we turn to the active defense analogy in the air defense type of thing to say it wasn't even that simple then, but it's even less simple now.
I want to go back to the Pearl Harbor analogy, because I think that's one that we see commonly used and you've referenced a couple of times. There were two, I think, in the book, looking at both the attack itself and then the aftermath and how response was delayed. What lessons can we take from these analogies?
Well, there are a number of them. I mean, the first one that people forget, but I think, you know, is important, is is ultimately that Pearl Harbor as an attack succeeded, but Japan ended up losing the war in any case. And one of the reasons for that that's explored in the analogy is that the U.S. was able to reconstitute its naval forces and other forces quickly and more quickly than Japan had thought. The Japanese attackers missed some of the infrastructure that was really crucial for the Navy's ability to carry on the fight. And so there the question is, if you're thinking about a cyber attack with the purpose that Japan had, no matter who you are, you have to be very, very confident that in fact you understand and have intelligence on all the crucial targets that you want to hit, but that your cyber operation will in fact be able to hit and disable those targets, right? And which you may not actually be sure of, or you may think you can do it, but in fact you don't have that effect, which means also that you really need to have enduring intelligence capability to assess whether your attack worked as you thought it did. And you have to have planned right in terms of how quickly the other side could reconstitute its capabilities to resume the fight against you. So in many ways, Pearl Harbor is a cautionary tale for the attacker, but for the defender, which is how most people think of the analogy. So when Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta in 2012, said the thing he's worried most about is a cyber Pearl Harbor attack on the U.S. He was thinking from, the U.S. side, the vulnerability of this big attack. He wasn't thinking about how it actually didn't work for Japan. And there, the analogy suggests, again, the need and the challenge of having to educate and mobilize and incentivize private actors who, in addition to the government, have to secure the space. The importance of coordinating the intelligence community and different sources of intelligence on attack. And that was famously a problem with Pearl Harbor, that there was intelligence. It hadn't been analyzed and synthesized for the government adequately. And so we know that that's the case right now with cyber. And the question is, whether the U.S. is mobilizing and whether Congress and others are providing the resources and guidance to prepare against that kind of attack.
I would only reinforce the first point that George had made, which is here was a case of an audacious, technically savvy, operationally brilliant maneuver to try and dig the Japanese out of a very precarious strategic situation, in which they in fact ended up not only one in which they miscalculated operationally how long it would take for the U.S. to rebound, but it was a catalyzing event that made it easier for the United States to mobilize all its might to go after Japan. So the lure is there, but sometimes there are unintended consequences and you unleash dynamics which ultimately take your situation wasn't great in the first place and make it even worse.
And as we suggested in this discussion several times, cyber may be tempting to pursue, cyber attacks may be tempting to pursue because you think, look, I can affect so much and I can do it without bloodshed. So the other side is going to be less motivated to come back at me as hard as they could. So why not do this? Now, as we explore in the book and in our other work, there may be, in fact, reasons why states and the rest of us should use cyber more to project power or for defensive purposes, precisely because they don't cause damage and kill people. On the other hand, you can be tempted to do something really audacious that actually ends up being massively miscalculated and can produce an escalation that you didn't expect at all.
If you now listen this week to the Russian trying to explain that their puzzlement over the U.S. overreaction to the to the attack on the U.S. electoral process and so on. They wanted to communicate a message probably and so on, but the fact that they would hit such a raw nerve that will come back and come back to haunt them, I think was and to this day they can't fully appreciate why in a democracy this is such a raw nerve.
Well, thank you for coming on to talk about your book. We've taken up a lot of your time. Before we let you go, could you tell us about what you're working on now?
Yes, what we're trying to do is one issue is with respect to trying to understand the role of the private sector and where what the government should encourage the private sector to do and what means to do so and what it should leave the government, the private sector to do using the kind of means for risk mitigation that it's always been using, like insurance and financing as ways of affecting behavior, as well as lawsuits and civil liability as type of behavior a modifying incentive. So that's one area that we're working on. And George has already mentioned that we're trying to combine this with the active defense type of discussion for the private sector. We're looking at some specific applications of cyber in conflict and in warfare, both in terms of targets as well as in terms of capabilities that could, for example, affect the positioning, navigation, and timing data or financial data, and as a result, wreak havoc and say, is it really something that you've asked for? We're trying to get to some key international players who have a capacity to shape this environment and show that there is more of a common interest in trying to set some rules of the road for this. And I think analytically, we are also trying to kind of understand some of the challenges of cyber conflict and some way of navigating yourself through it in terms of what can you hope to accomplish in dealing with cyber conflict as well as in employing cyber tools in those scenarios.
That sounds like a great project. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Understanding Cybersecurity, 14 Analogies, edited by George Perkovich and Ariel Levite, is available now from Georgetown University Press. You can follow the New Books Network on Twitter at New Books Network and the New Books Network National Security Channel at New Books NatSec.